So, good morning. My name is Chelsea Duval. I'm currently a PhD student at the University of Wyoming, but today I'm going to talk to you about my master's thesis research, which I recently defended, titled Impacts of Oyster Aquaculture on Subaqueous Soils in Resident and Fauna in Rhode Island Coastal Lagoons. And as you see here, we're set in that coastal lagoon setting with our in fauna living within those subaqueous soils. I'd like to start by acknowledging my advisors, my lab mates, as well as my funding sources for this research. So I'm going to go through the background of this study, as well as my objectives and hypotheses, methods, results, and wrap up with some conclusions. So to begin, we'll set the scene of what is aquaculture. By definition, the cultivation, rearing, or propagation of aquatic plants or animals under either natural or artificial conditions. For the sake of this project, we studied oyster aquaculture, or oyster farming, as you see here in one of our local coastal lagoons. In Rhode Island, oysters account for 98% of Rhode Island aquaculture, so that is pretty much the whole industry. And as such, we have different types of ways that you can farm oysters, but in Rhode Island, with the exception of one farm, there are almost exclusively these off-bottom methods. So that sets these oyster racks, as you see in the red box, roughly 8 to 10 centimeters above the soil surface, set within the water column. In addition to the majority of these practices being the off-bottom culture, a majority of these sites are actually sited in what we call our coastal lagoons. And that accounts for roughly 50%. I actually think this has increased in the past year. As you can see here, we have roughly four coastal ponds that are utilized for oyster aquaculture, and they also use the bay as well. But these are more shallow settings, and we'll get a little bit further into what those sites actually look like. But 50% of that 98%, so this is a significant portion of the industry sited in these coastal lagoons. So what are the actual impacts of oyster aquaculture on the lagoon environment? Here we have a single adult oyster. They range roughly 6 to 7 centimeters in size. A single oyster can filter upwards of 55 gallons of water per day. And in this process, they take in phytoplankton, nitrogen and carbon, as well as particulate matter, filtering that through their system, metabolizing all of those nutrients and food, releasing out the filtered water, but there's also this third component, the other side of the story, which are these biodeposits, which collectively are called biodeposits, but this is the feces and pseudo-feces of the oyster. And that's an organic rich load full of nitrogen and carbon. And ultimately what happens with these biodeposits is it undergoes four phases, either remineralization, consumption by biodeposit feeders, so those in fauna that we had talked about before, burial within the soil, so down into those deeper depths, or undergoes denitrification or anamox. And in addition to these processes, within these coastal lagoons, we also have this effect of physical disturbances occurring. So that's your farmers walking around, maintaining their aquaculture structures, as well as dragging their boats along in these areas. So as you can see, there's a lot going on, both within the water column and the soil environment. So even though aquaculture is this big new industry coming into not only Rhode Island, but expanding throughout New England and elsewhere, few studies have actually assessed the impact of aquaculture practices on subaqueous soils. In addition, we found little research on quantified soil and in sea levels at depth, like we had talked about before. And few studies have examined the infaunal communities interacting within those soil environments. And that is why for our study, it was our primary objective to assess the impacts of aquaculture on soil properties and infauna over various durations of aquaculture use. And I'll get a little bit more into this. Essentially what we expected to see is, as we talked about these oysters expelling those biodeposits to the soil environment, we expect the nitrogen and carbon loads to increase, as well as those soil disturbances, resulting in this function of soil impact and in fauna impact. So decreased bulk density, which we use as a proxy for disturbance, nitrogen and carbon levels would increase with those loads of biodeposition, as well as increased sulfide levels. So hydrogen sulfides, those really rotten egg smelling, stinky smells out there on the ocean, as well as in fauna impact. So increases in abundance with those biodeposits going down into those environments creates food for these organisms. And likewise, at a certain rate, we hypothesized that increased biodeposition could overwhelm those systems, and we would see this shift with the trophic communities. And essentially, as a function of all of these factors, we expect these to increase the longer a site has been used for aquaculture. So again, to set the scene, here we are in the coastal pond region of Rhode Island. We selected three coastal ponds set on the south coast. And from here, we're pretty fortunate that our subaqueous soils are mapped out in Rhode Island. When I say subaqueous soils, for some of you in the room who may not be aware, these are soils that are roughly 2 meters maximum in depth under the water. Here we have a brackish setting. I don't have a laser pointer, but you can see there's a barrier beach. And on the other side where you start to see the blue towards the right, that's your open ocean. So these coastal ponds are set just behind that barrier beach environment. And for our sites, we were located all on this Nagant sand soil type. It's roughly 97% sand, so pretty coarse. And located on what we call the washover fan. So it's very shallow, sandy environment. From here, we were able to use Google aerial imagery, and you can actually see these oyster aquaculture farms just sitting out there from those images, which is pretty great. We use a time hop tool to establish age sites. So within each oyster farm or lease, you could go back in time and see when they were established. So that allowed us to stratify our age sites from 0 to 21 years of use, and those 0 age sites are our control sites within each pond. So from here, we took core samples, a modification of VibroCore methods. We did it by hand, so we were the vibration. We sampled down to 20 centimeters, where most in fauna are thought to live. We stratified that into 4 different depth increments, which I'll get into with my results. And again, we analyzed for bulk density, nitrogen, carbon, soil pore water sulfide levels. And then for our in fauna, we looked at species, functional feeding groups, and diversity. So to get into our results, to orient you, on the y-axis we have bulk density, and on the x we have that duration of aquaculture use. There's 2 6-year age sites because they were both located in 2 different ponds. Essentially what we found for bulk density was these numbers varied across the board. We did see lower surface bulk density at some aquaculture sites, indicating these specific sites could have been highly disturbed. But one thing that's pretty interesting is the variation is across the board. So this is occurring at both control and aquaculture sites, specifically within those surface environments. If we look at total nitrogen and carbon, here we have nitrogen first. Again, Y and X axes are similar to bulk density. What we found is that roughly 5 out of the 8 sites, including the control site, had nitrogen burial at depth. So to orient you further, the different colors represent those depth increments that we had talked about. So the blue and the orange represent your surface soil, as well as the gray and yellow are your deeper depths. And we see this trend occurring a lot at our aquaculture sites. So we're seeing nitrogen being buried further into the soil profile. Similarly, we see the same trend with carbon, with a few other sites having a bit more carbon deeper in those profiles. This could be due to translocation by your infaunal communities, as well as other processes of nitrogen and carbon occurring in the surface soils. So soil pore water sulfides. Some of you may be familiar with these IRIS tube methods. Essentially, IRIS stands for Indicator of Reduction in Soils, tube method. But what we use them for, as opposed to analyzing reducing conditions, is to measure the sulfide levels. So again, those rotten egg smelling sulfides in your coastal environment. The way that we analyze it here on these tubes is the extent of that black color change. So the sulfides within the soils will react with the iron paint on the tubes, which is that orange that you see, essentially leaving behind this insoluble black monosulfide. And if we look at our control versus aquaculture sites, it's pretty evident that we have a greater black color change on our aquaculture sites. And this was clear across all aquaculture sites compared to control sites. So this subset is representative of all of our tubes that we took. And furthermore, if we look at the 0 to 10 depth range, we see a really strong dark color change. So that's indicative of a lot of sulfides within that surface environment. That was pretty interesting to see. So if we look further into the infauna that are actually living in these soils, we did a top 5 species analysis, which actually composed roughly 70% of the majority of species found at all of these sites. And if we compare our control to our aquaculture sites, we find similar species. Approximately 3 of the species were the same at both sites. But what's interesting about this is if we look at the top 2 species at the aquaculture sites, we have the Corophium volutator and the Capitella capitata, which are both considered opportunistic species, your interface and deposit feeders, bottom feeders, as we may say. We see those at the control sites, but we see higher amounts here, and also your Corophium and your Capitella capitata are indicative of disturbance. This is well known throughout the literature. And if we quickly look into the functional analysis, so our functional feeding groups, how those infauna are actually interacting with the soils and acquiring their food, we see higher amounts of deposit feeders in our aquaculture sites if we're comparing by just site type. But if we look at these trends over time, we see slight variation in total abundance. But what's interesting is we see a peak at this 6 to kind of 12-year range in total abundance. And in addition to that, we see significantly more interface feeders as well as deposit feeders at some of these aquaculture sites. And what's even more interesting is after that peak that we see around the 6 to 12-year range, we start to see a decline in total abundance approaching those older age sites, almost returning back to near initial conditions. So that was pretty fascinating to see in the trends. And we see an inverse relationship for the diversity. And just finally with that, to conclude, we're looking at this really dynamic environment. You have constant water flow, interactions with the farmers. So we didn't see changes in soil properties or infauna over time, nor differences in those properties correlated to the abundances of infauna. We did see an increase in those infauna in interface feeders favoring those opportunistic species. So this could be indicative of higher disturbance at aquaculture sites, as well as starting to question, do those sulfides play a part? Sulfides are typically toxic to those infauna, so it would be interesting to dive a little bit deeper into the dynamics of that. So with that, think a little bit more about those worms every once in a while, and I'll take any questions.